On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Novelist Richard Russo, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of 2001's Empire Falls, grew up in the kind of small, gritty town that he's written about for more than two decades. He knows the pride of blue-collar work, the shame of not having enough, and about the neighbors who live just a little too close. In his new novel, Bridge of Sighs, Russo tells the story of those who stay in the small town of Thomaston, New York, where the river runs red with dye from the tannery, and the East End kids and the West End kids just don't mix, and what happens when one leaves. Up next, On Point, Richard Russo's America. Joining me now in the studio is Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist Richard Russo. His books include Empire Falls, Nobody's Fool, and Straight Man. Empire Falls became a 2005 HBO miniseries, and Nobody's Fool, a film starring Paul Newman. His new book is Bridge of Sighs, which the New York Times called enormously moving and full of insight and gentle humor. Richard Russo, it's so nice to have you with us. Thanks for coming.
Hi, Jane.
So I pulled up some of your reviews. Hope you don't mind. The critics say this: nobody writes about struggling small towns and the working class better than you. They called you the patron saint of small town fiction. What keeps drawing you back to small town America?
Well, I've lived most of my life in small towns. There was one brief period when I was getting educated out in Tucson, Arizona, at the university out there, that I lived in an actual city. Other than that, I was born in Johnstown, New York, small town, and grew up right nearby in Gloversville. Since then, I've lived in Altoona, Pennsylvania, which was kind of my fictional Railton was based on that, and lived in Waterville, Maine, in nearby Skowhegan, which was kind of, those two kind of served as the backdrop for Empire Falls. And I now live in a very different kind of small town in Camden, Maine. So I'm kind of used to that. I've been looking at those places for the better part of my 58 years.
And what have you seen?
Oh, well, the towns that I know best and the ones that I write about are towns in transition. It was odd in a way to write Empire Falls because I was writing about a mill town in transition. It didn't know it was in transition, but at the end of that HBO film based on the book, the abandoned mill has been bought. A calling card company has moved in. They've opened up a couple of shishi restaurants. there are lofts on the top floor of the condo,
right.
And you look at all of that, and the river has been cleaned up, and a rainbow arcs over
cue the music.
over the whole scene.
Yeah.
That, unfortunately, is not what happens to a lot of mill towns. And the ones that I have been most interested in are the ones that have not been lucky and have not been blessed, and whose hardworking people have either lost their jobs entirely or had to settle for jobs that aren't nearly as rewarding, either financially or psychologically or any other way, as the jobs that they lost.
So tell us about the small town, this Gloversville, where you grew up, where the town took its whole identity from a product, really, that wasn't made there anymore.
Exactly. I was talking to a cousin. I was back in Gloversville recently for a family event, and one of my cousins had come in. She lives in Buffalo now, and she had come in, and somebody said, "You're going to Gloversville? Well, get me a pair of gloves." And so they spent the better part of the day before going all around Gloversville and Johnstown, and there used to be dozens of glove shops all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
And she could not find a pair of gloves made in Gloversville, New York.
Mm-hmm.
Now, even when I was growing up, back in the 50s, there was already a sense that after World War II, that it was never going to be the same again. There were still gloves being cut. My grandfather was still working at the time. He was a glove cutter. But the sense was that that wasn't going to continue much longer. Gloves were already being imported into Gloversville, completely made except for maybe a button or two to be sewed on so that you could put that Made in Gloversville mm-hmm. label on it. Mm-hmm. And everybody had the sense that before long they weren't going to have even that. And that's, of course, the way it worked out. It was a slow, strangling death.
And I read someplace that you grew up feeling, quote, a sense of diminishment. Tell me what you meant by that.
You know, I feel more of a sense of diminishment about it now, looking back on it, than I think I did at the time. What I sensed, and what so many people of my generation felt in that town, and you know, by extension, mill towns all across America, what we were coming to terms with was the fact that our parents were telling us that if we were going to make anything of ourselves, if we were going to have any opportunity, we were simply going to have to leave, that there was just really no possibility to live the kind of life, not so much that we were dreaming for ourselves, but the kind of lives that they were dreaming for us. Mm-hmm. We were going to have to leave. And so I think what we all recognized was not a sense of so much a sense of diminishment of our own lives, because I had a relatively happy childhood there. I didn't know we weren't rich. Nobody around had any money either. So there wasn't a lot of comparison in that respect. The neighborhoods, everybody in the neighborhood had about the same amount of money, I think, which was not much. But I didn't feel any sense of diminishment so much there, except that I knew that the future wasn't there. And that, I suppose, is a different kind of diminishment.
And so Bridge of Sighs, then, is about somebody who stays in the small town and somebody who leaves.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, it's
right?
That simple, really. Yeah.
One character does go all the way to Venice. Another runs convenience stores in upstate New York. Give us a brief description of the book, if you would, Richard Russo.
Well, that's a good place to start. I've always, as a writer, the more, you know, kind of education that I've taken on the longer that I've written, I've always had a sense that I was someone who had both left the town and somehow stayed behind. And despite the fact that I don't get back to Gloversville very often anymore, I've continued to write about it. So I've always had this sense of both leaving and staying at the same time. Mm-hmm. Probably not many people have that sense, because imaginatively, in some ways, I've never left. But of course, in another respect, I'm more like Robert Noonan of the two characters in this novel. There's Lou Lynch and Robert Noonan. Lou is the man who stays. He's really never left this town. He's never been beyond the county line, as it mm-hmm, were. Mm-hmm. And Noonan, on the other hand, has achieved a degree of fame as a painter. He's brawled his way across Europe through the major European capitals and ended up at 60 years old, kind of half broken down and in Venice. And so the dramatic arc of their lives could not be more different.
Tell us about the Bridge of Sighs, the 16th century bridge, and right. How it works, how the title works into the theme of the book.
Sure. Well, the Bridge of Sighs in Venice is a famous bridge and an extraordinarily beautiful bridge, too. And it was historically famous because the bridge itself connected the Doge's Palace, which was where all the civil trials took place. So if you were brought before the magistrate and you were convicted, and even more importantly than that, if you were convicted and you had no friends, or you had no influence, mm-hmm. or you had no money, mm-hmm. then your conviction was going to mean that you would cross that bridge from the Doge's palace with all of its splendor, and you were going to descend on the other side of the canal into the dungeons. And without influence, that's where you were going to stay probably for the rest of your life. And so the Bridge of Sighs for such men, the legend was that you could hear their sighs of despair echoing throughout the canal as they crossed that bridge. It became for me a very potent symbol because of the class issues that I was going to be dealing with in the novel.
Mm-hmm.
It was going to be a novel about, among other things, despair, but it was also going to be a particular kind of despair that had to do with privilege, that had to do with money or the lack thereof, and friends. And to cross the bridge of size in this novel is to talk about melancholy, despair, sadness. And it was very helpful to me, too, because, of course, there are bridges throughout this novel. There's a very important local bridge in Thomaston. And Venice is a city of bridges.
And your main character, as you mentioned, Lou Lynch, the prospect of leaving that town that he knows scares him to death, doesn't
yes,
it?
Yes, yes. Leaving Thomaston scares Lou every bit as much as Noonan is scared by the prospect of returning, because at 60, he's about to have his first show of his paintings in the United States, in New York, in a couple of decades. And, of course, he's kept in contact, or rather Lou has kept in contact with him. So the prospect of returning to the United States and possibly returning to Thomaston is just bone-chilling to him.
Richard, if you would, I'd love you to read some from Bridge of Sighs. Could you?
Sure. This will introduce the listener to one of the three major characters who are present throughout this novel. My father was Louis Patrick Lynch, Big Lou to his friends. In christening me Louis Charles, the Charles for my mother's father, they meant for me to be called Lou as well, though I've been known all my life by a nickname given to me on the first day of kindergarten at Cuyahoga Elementary School. Miss Vincent's roll sheet contained her students' first names, their middle initials, and, of course, their surnames. If that's what she had read that first morning, Louis C. Lynch, I suspect I'd have had a different childhood. Though, if she hadn't made the mistake, maybe somebody else would have later. She knew my father, and you couldn't blame her for assuming that I was called Lou. And if she'd said Lou Lynch, everything would have been fine. But for some reason, she chose also to read my middle initial. Lou C. Lynch was the name she called, and when she did, I raised my hand. The other children turned to look at me, and I could tell by their puzzled looks that something had occurred, something I alone had missed. Even then, all might have been fine if Miss Vincent had simply noted my raised hand and proceeded down her list to the next name. Instead, she paused, her ear registering what her eye had missed. And in her hesitation, that empty beat, someone said, "His name is Lucy?"
There's so much in this book about destiny and how the early events of one's life affect their entire life.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. It's true in real life. It's certainly one of the major themes of this particular book. I mean, you asked me earlier why I'm interested in small towns, and part of it is that I think those experiences that we have in our early lives are the things that tend to color the rest of our lives, even when we wish that they wouldn't. For all three of the characters, the major characters in this book, things happen to them in their childhood and adolescence that in some cases color and in some cases actually determine the kind of or limit the kind of destiny that they're going to find in life.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And this is in a way kind of a strange book because it divides itself between the novel opens with all three of these characters having just turned 60 years old. So they've kind of made the final turn, even though we tell ourselves now that 60 is the new 50. We all know that 60 is more than halfway there,
if we're
going to be honest at all about it. So they've made the turn into the straightaway of their lives. So you get in this book, you get the third act of their life, but you also get the first act. And kind of what you're left to do is to intuit what the whole second act of their lives, the long act, the second act is the long one. But in some ways, it's far less significant in terms of one's destiny than the first act and the third act. And those are the two acts that we get in this book.
In the book, you describe the main setting, the town of Thomaston, as both, I love these, the description of this, as both luxuriant and demanding. What did you mean by that?
The town of Thomaston is luxuriant and demanding? Yeah. Well, it's a... In terms of the class themes of the novel, it's a novel that is divided in the way so many American towns are divided. One of the reasons I love to write about small towns is precisely because of that division. This is a town, the street that runs right through the center of the town is called Division Street. and it does in fact do exactly that, because on one side of Division Street in the West End is where all the poor people live. And they tend to be those immigrants into the town who have come there most recently, and they have the least money. And it's also the West End, most of it is that part of the town that is closest to the stream. And this is not the kind of town where you want to be on the water, because the stream is being polluted. Mm-hmm. And so the people with the least money are the ones closest to the stream and are later going to be the ones who have the highest rates of cancer. Once you cross the stream and once you cross Division Street, then you move into the East End, where the lower middle class working people live. And they have probably been around for a little bit longer. They're a generation or two. They've been there for a generation or two longer in this country. So there's a big deal in this town about moving across Division Street into the nicer, yet ever so, you know, lower middle class.
Well, it is a real detailed map of the classes,
yes,
right? Yeah. The middle class lives here. The lower class, as you just described, lower middle class across the tracks, the more affluent live in the borough, you know, this sort of thing.
Yeah.
What's the picture you're trying to paint? If you get the class right, the town will somehow feel, I don't know, familiar or something to the reader?
Yeah. Well, you know, I'll tell you a funny story about that. I worried a lot with my novel Empire Falls if I was going to get Maine right, because Mainers are fiercely territorial. They love their Maine. They love their state. And no matter how long you live there, you're from away. And I wanted to get that right.
Yeah.
But what I've discovered over the years is that people confuse place and class.
Mm-hmm.
If you get class right, place just follows. They understand that, because that's the map that's imprinted in our brain, I think, is the class map. And so when I write about Empire Falls, Maine, and I tour in Mississippi, people tell me, you got my town so right.
You nailed it, yeah. I want to go to the phones, because lots of folks are anxious to join this conversation. And Rita is one of them, calling from Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts. Hi, Rita, you're on the line. Go ahead.
Hi there. Good to speak with you. And Mr. Russo, I'm from Gloversville, New York.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
It's a real treat. Real treat to hear our town mentioned on the radio. And you and I are approximately the same age, although my guess is you graduated from Bishop Burke.
I did indeed. You recognize all that Catholic guilt, do you?
I do. It came through loud and clear. And one of my favorite of your books was Nobody's Fool, and the movie I thought was exquisite.
Oh, thank you.
I'm wondering if the tavern was Quigley's Tavern. Because Quigley's was a place on Main Street in Gloversville where we all hung out, and some people of questionable background and relationship found their home there. And that's what it felt like to me when I saw Nobody's Fool.
All of my taverns are based on Quigley's Tavern, and one or two others.
Good. I'm
Nick's,
so glad to
Nick's
hear
in
that.
Downtown Gloversville was another one. My father and I visited them all. We had our favorites. But, Quigley's was certainly one of the spots.
Mm. Yeah, and I remember having you say something about the glove industry. When I graduated from high school, I got a wardrobe of gloves. I was given from one friend short gloves, long gloves, leather gloves, elbow-length gloves, red gloves, black gloves, white gloves. I mean, that was it. That was Gloversville.
That was
it was about all the tanneries and the glove factories, and it defined our lives. And I, too, have left.
Do you still have them all? Are they still in pristine condition?
If they were in pristine condition, they'd probably be on eBay.
So
sorry to say I don't have them. read it. Also interesting to hear your connection to Tucson, Arizona, because now I live in Jamaica Plain, Boston, but we spend a great deal of time in Tucson. And if you haven't been back there either lately, you wouldn't recognize it.
I know. It's
That's such
huge,
an interesting part of your history. Rita, thank you for your call about what the evolution of your life out there during college and that time in Arizona and coming back home then and deciding whether you really want to go back to that other life.
My early career as a writer was an exercise in flight, actually. When I went out to the University of Arizona, it was because I wanted to get a very, very long way from Gloversville, New York. Mm-hmm. I wanted to be a big city. I wanted to live in a city. Mm-hmm. I wanted to be thought urban and sophisticated. Mm-hmm. I was neither of those things, but I aspired to those qualities. And the more education I got out there, because I did, if you promise not to tell anyone, I did, you know, a BA and then an MA and then a PhD and then an MFA and an MFA. And every one of those degrees, in a way, took me, in one sense, a little bit farther from Gloversville, New York, but also from Mohawk, New York, and also from North Bath, New York. And I thought when I first started writing that really my job as a writer would be to conceal who I was, where I came from. And it was only after failing miserably in my graduate work to write compelling and believable stories about cities like Tucson that it suddenly dawned on me that I was ignoring the wealth of material that I knew best. And it took me, you know, a smarter person would have tumbled to that right away. It took me probably 4 or 5 years to realize that.
So interesting. Let's go back to the phones and Heather now, who's calling from Boston. Hi, Heather, go ahead.
Hi, Jane. Hi, Richard. I just wanted to say that I was born in Maine and spent my formative years in South Glens Falls, New York, not too far away from Gloversville.
Yeah.
And I loved Empire Falls. I thought that was fantastic. One thing I've noticed about the communities there is that as they become more bedroom communities to the big cities, they kind of lose the charm and the almost classlessness that was there, too. Like, we all thought we were on the same level when we lived there. There was not much rich or poor.
Yeah.
It's a really small step between
good
the
point.
Two.
Heather, thank you so much. They do. They lose their charm, don't they?
Yeah, and as happened fictionally in Empire Falls and happens in real life all over is that when towns that are down on their luck get lucky, they don't get lucky very often for the people who actually live in them. They get lucky for the people who are moving in and investing money. Mm-hmm. And so for the people like Miles Roby in Empire Falls, and all of the people from his diner, the fact that Empire Falls ends up in the end a lucky town doesn't mean that it's necessarily lucky for the people who built it. As Miles puts it, the people who built this town instead of the people who just think they did.
Mm. Thanks so much, Heather. I have another question for you, Richard. One of your strengths in all of your work has been writing about fathers and sons. But in Bridge of Sighs, your strongest characters are women.
Yeah.
Lucy's mother and wife, some of the wisest folks in town. And I wonder if this was intentional, if you meant to do that.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I think it's the women characters who drive this book. They drive the action of the book. They are the sharper knives in the drawer, that's for sure. the men, I think, in this book and in a couple of my other books what you can say about them is they're deeply mysterious even to themselves. And I think that the women are far more realistic. They've been paying attention more. I think that this is what you're probably fixing on is a kind of gradual transition that's taken place over my career as a writer. My earlier books were about fathers and sons, but also about men misbehaving.
Mm-hmm.
That was great fun. But as one reviewer pointed out at the end of the risk pool, I was ignoring one whole gender. And that kind of hit home, that comment hit home, because at that time, my daughters, I have two daughters, my daughters were both young at that time. My wife, my two daughters, my mother was still alive at that point. And really, all the important people in my life were women. And so it became more important to me to get those good female characters into the novels, too.
I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. Richard Russo, you come from a long line of storytellers. Your dad, I've read, was at the top of the list, right?
Yeah.
He was, shall we say, an embellisher of sorts.
I can think of a couple of other words, but we'll probably leave them alone on the radio.
Story never came out the same way twice, did it?
No, never. That was part of the joy. I mean, and he was such an ebullient storyteller that he would forget, among other things, the fact that you were there. You know, he would tell a story, and he would forget that the person he was telling it to had actually been there, and then he'd embellish anyway. You know, and I always used to just let him go, just let him ramble, and then finally, when he was done, say, "Dad, are you telling me that you really don't remember that I was there?" And he'd say, "Oh yeah, yeah. Well, then you remember."
I want to take another caller in here. Alex from Cornish, Maine. Hi, Alex, you're on the line. Go ahead.
Hi there. I was just wondering if you have any advice for writers who come from similar areas that would like to stick with the areas that they're from, who would like to stay back home.
Alex, thank you.
A couple of things. One is that you can learn a little quicker than I did that that wherever you come from, you and your place and your people, there's no particular reason why they shouldn't be the subject matter for literature any more than any other place. We're all equal in that respect. My advice to writers is generally the same no matter where they come from. Read incessantly and recognize the fact that writing is a lot like selling insurance. I mean, you just have to do it every day, or you never get much good at it.
So I was wondering if you still feel the weight of your parents' dreams. You talked about your grandfather, who was a glove maker, and your parents and how they lived. And you know, you didn't have much growing up, but you felt that your parents had dreams for you. Do you still feel that?
Absolutely.
As you write?
Absolutely. I think if anything, more so now, the older that I get, I feel that weight more than I did as a young man. I feel now the foundation as I put brick upon top of brick that is my life. And as I see my daughters who have now grown from childhood there into young women, and I look at what their lives are like. One of my daughters now lives in London and has traveled far more than either her mother or father. That's also true of my older daughter, Emily, who now lives in Amherst, but who has been working in New York for a long time. They have both been places in the world that my maternal grandmother and grandfather only dreamed of. My grandmother would have given anything in the world to go to Ireland. She actually envied my grandfather his travels when he was in World War I and World War II. That just gives you an idea. What is it like to envy, to want to travel so badly that you envy somebody who's getting shot at because they at least are in Europe or in Southeast Asia or wherever?
You know, I'd love to ask you what it feels like to win the Pulitzer Prize.
Well, it's the gift that keeps on giving. You know, it's as people say, you already know the first line of your obituary.
Well, so then the follow to that is your novels are ambitious in scope, in plot, in context. What kind of writer are you? How do you work?
Wrong. Well, you know, I'm a slogger. That's what I said in connection with the last caller. Is that writing? If you're writing the kinds of books that I write, it's certainly most important. I think it's important for anybody. But I'm a slogger. I realize that I learn as I go. I write books for the same reason that I read them, to find out what happens next. And it's very necessary for me to get a couple of pages a day. I tend not to binge. I stop when things are going real good so that I'm happy to come back to it the next day.
Mm-hmm. And you write first thing in the morning.
And I usually, yes, I always write in the morning for a couple of hours. If I'm lucky, I get two or three pages. They go on disc in the afternoon. If you do that every day, and I generally do it when I'm working on a novel 7 days a week, it's not a long day, but it's a day. And, And it's amazing how fast the pages pile up. People think at this, you know, if you only write 2 pages a day, God, how long is it going to take for you to come out with a novel?
Well, this is 528 pages long. You know, when you say you don't plot it out, you juggle so many characters. There's so many themes and places and time periods.
It does take a while.
Do you have charts on the board, or what, do you just remember it all?
I don't have charts on the board, but I do revise endlessly. And people who read a complex book like Bridge of Sighs often ask, how do you keep it all straight? And I always tell them, what's something that's pretty close to the truth, which is that I don't keep it all straight, at least not at any one time. I just revise endlessly until the ducks are all facing in the same direction.
Mm-hmm. Back to the phones, Richard, to Skip, who's calling from Knott's Island, North Carolina. Hi, Skip. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you. I work construction, and for years I worked for a company that did malls, and so we would go into, like, small towns, and they would have, you know, Main Street would consist of a shoe store and maybe a 3-generation clothing store and optometrist. Then we build this generic kind of mall, and when we built it, it would kind of wipe out Main Street. And, you know, and then you have this product that when you walked in there, you could close your eyes and you could be in any town and anywhere in the United States and see the same stores and the same things. And it's just, it was kind of a devastating. I know that one of the last places I worked, it just, like I said, it just destroyed downtown. And so I can appreciate the kind of feeling of the struggle in those small towns like that.
Skip, thank you.
Yeah, thanks. Thank you. That's exactly what's happening, I think, in America, alas, is that, you know, you get off any exit, off any freeway in the country, and you see pretty much the same thing. You can travel from one end of the country to the other and kind of have the sense that you didn't really go anywhere.
Mm-hmm. Read another bit from the book, would you, Richard?
Sure. This is Lucy again. In one sense, this is a novel about one boy who stays and one boy who leaves, but it's also about one boy who loves, indeed adores his father, and another boy who hates his. This is Lucy talking about his father. The self that I meet coming and going in Thomaston is, I confess, relentlessly unexceptional. I'm a large man, like my father. And the resemblance has always been a source of pleasure to me. I loved him more than I can say. So much that even now, many years after his death, it's hard for me to hear, much less speak, a word against him. Still, there's also something bittersweet about our resemblance. I am, I believe, an intelligent man. But I'll admit, this isn't always the impression I convey to others. Over the course of a lifetime, a man will overhear a fair number of remarks about himself and learn from them how very wide is the gulf between his public perception and the image that he hopes to project. I've always known that there's more going on inside me than finds its way into the world, but this is probably true of everyone. Who doesn't regret that he isn't more fully understood? I tend to be both self-conscious and reticent. Where others regret speaking in haste, wishing that they could recall some unkind or ill-considered opinion, I more often have occasion to regret what I have not said. Worse, these regrets accumulate and become a kind of verbal dam, preventing utterance of any sort until the dam finally breaks and I blurt something with inappropriate urgency, the time for that particular observation having long passed. As a result, until people get to know me, they often conclude that I'm slow. And in this, also, I'm like my father.
Hmm. You read that, and it reminds me, actually, of a commencement speech that I read of yours in conjunction with researching for this interview, which you gave at Colby College a few years back. And you describe unashamedly And in advocating a kind of old-fashionedness among relationships and among the kind of life that you were suggesting that these graduates live. And I wonder, in your book and as you speak outside, what is your message? What do you tell young people about life and of growing up and what's really important?
Yeah, I had. It's interesting. You know, you call that up in doing your research, it's amazing how many people have had access to that speech that I gave at Colby College, and I get asked about it a lot. And many of the people who have commented on that liked the speech. But then they said, too, they were surprised at how the word they used wasn't old-fashioned. The word that they used was conservative. And they happen to know me. Those of them who know me or think that they know me have judged that that I am fairly politically liberal, and they were surprised that I was giving the graduates of Colby College what seemed to them such conservative advice. You know, find someone to love in your life, have children. You know, one of the things I told the Colby, I made a joke out of it. I said, you know, after what you've put your parents through, you really deserve children of your own, and you should have them. But I was giving what sounded to people like very conservative advice, and that's what I generally tell people is that I mean, there's a long tradition in America of political liberalism joined with cultural conservatism, and I think a lot of what my books are about is the way those two seemingly different vectors connect in the world.
Hmm. That's so interesting. Let's go back to the phones. Christian now is calling from Columbia, South Carolina. Hi, Christian. Go ahead. You're on the line.
Hi. How are you doing?
Hi. Good.
Richard, I love academic fiction novels that are set on college campuses, and I actually study them a little bit. And I think Straight Man is the best example out there.
Thank you.
Wondering if I should say that I first read it while I was working in an academic administration type job and loved it. And then I moved to State College, Pennsylvania, to do my PhD at Penn State.
Uh-huh.
And spent some time in Altoona and then learned to love it on a different level. I was wondering, what are some of your favorite college, so-called college novels, and have you ever thought of writing another novel set on a campus?
Christian, thanks.
Yeah, I can take the last one first. No, I think I've expelled all of that academic stuff out of my system in that one book. I flushed it, one clean flush, and it's all gone. Although I have to say, I have a lot more material. So if I ever go back on that, I would never say never. But if I go back on that, people say, "Boy, you must have used every academic story you knew." And I say, "I barely scratched the surface. There's a lot more out there." But I think I'm probably done with academic fiction. If you love academic novels, there are two that I would suggest to you that you may not know. I don't know how wide and deep your reading has gone, but if you like Straight Man, you really need to read Michael Malone's Fool's Cap. I think that is probably, if not the funniest, certainly right up there, the one or two funniest academic novels I've ever read. And I don't know if it's still in print. If not, then shame on all of us for allowing such a great novel to go out of print. The other one is a serious novel called Stoner. I recommend both of those to you.
Christian touched on what you might be writing next. So I read, actually, that after you wrote Bridge of Sighs, that you didn't really want to write another book right away. Is that true?
That's true.
Unlike the other books that you've written, that you start one right
usually,
away.
Usually when I finish a novel, if I'm planning to work 2 hours and I finish a novel and I only have I've only worked 1 hour, I'll start a new novel. But this time, part of it is that I'm working on a screenplay, and I'll probably do that. But the real reason is that this book took more out of me than any novel that I've ever written before.
Why?
And I think it has something to do with the fact that it's very difficult to write a book about despair without. I feel kind of like I got half, like Lucy, I got halfway across the Bridge of Sighs in this book myself in some way, and came back again, coming out the other end of that, I just felt kind of drained. I was just glad to have come out of the other end of that. I'm glad that I wrote this book at this particular time because I don't have anything to be despairing about. I was in good...
Well, I was going to ask you, there must be some despair in your own life.
No, there isn't. There really isn't. I live an absolutely blessed existence, and this was a good time for me to write a book about this particular subject. I wouldn't have wanted to write it if at the beginning of it I was actually feeling any of that. I just kind of went there with Lucy and Noonan and Sarah and got so involved with them that I shared some of their pain, I think.
Back to the phones, Richard. Chris is now calling from Brighton, Massachusetts. Hi, Chris. You're on the line.
Hi. Hi, Jane. Hi, Richard. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just want to take the opportunity, Richard, to admire publicly and to thank you for one of your short stories, The Horse Child.
Oh, thank you.
And you were talking a few minutes ago about how, for many of your characters, destiny is inflicted on them. And without spoiling the plot of that story, which is wonderful, there's a moment where the story is about a writing class, and the narrator is the instructor in the writing class. One of the students is an elderly nun,
right,
who's basically narrating her existence, and she's telling, you know, what seem to be long, rambly stories about her childhood, and yet they become fascinating to the other students in the class, who are ultimately given the opportunity to critique her. And there's an observation of what seems obvious to, I think, the reader and the other students in the class that is completely new information to the elderly nun. So at the moment when this is about to be revealed, the instructor says something like, you know, his heart was in his throat or something like that. And I wanted to ask you, why, can you talk a little bit more about why his heart was in his throat? What is the danger of people, you know, having a new perspective on the events of their experience?
Interesting. Chris, thank you. Good question.
Yes, it's a wonderful question. Yeah. Thank you. I think that old Sister Ursula has a fair amount is very similar to Lucy Lynch in Bridge of Sighs. Both of these people, late in life, feel absolutely compelled to tell their stories. They have lived a life very different from the life that they imagined living. And the urge to tell a story, very often people think that they want to tell stories because they know the story and they understand the story that they want to tell, and they want to get the information out to other people. Very often the urge to tell a story is that the teller doesn't understand the story herself or himself. And the great pain that Sister Ursula has to go through to tell that story is based, I think, on the fact that deep in her subconscious, she knows the meaning of that story. She knows the terrible, terrible lie that she has kept from herself for all of these years. And I think that the reason that the narrator of the story, his heart is in his throat, is that he has known for some time what this poor woman's secret is. And therefore, the person who's hearing the story is in a position, strangely enough, of greater wisdom than the person who's telling it. And that's also true of Lucy Lynch, I think, in Bridge of Sighs.
I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. Just wrapping up here, Richard, I wonder, after all the great success that you've had with your writing, winning the Pulitzer Prize, all the traveling that you've done and people that you've met, I wonder what you miss most about life in that small town that you came from.
In a word, innocence. That's why you can't go back, right? I think we were talking earlier about the fact that you know, all of us kids in this one real town, Gloversville, New York, and all of these kids in Bridge of Sighs, in the front story to Bridge of Sighs. When you're a kid, when you're innocent, you don't know that it's strange. You think that your family life is the most normal thing in the world. You think that the place that you live in is the best place in the world. And life is new to you. Your experiences, because they haven't happened to you before, are in technicolor. The 10th time something happens to you, it's not in technicolor anymore. And that's just as it should be. That's life going from innocence to experience. Most young people are very anxious for that to happen, and it's only after it has begun to happen that you realize what you can't have anymore.
Well, congratulations on a beautiful book, The Bridge of Sighs, Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Empire Falls. This is Richard Russo's latest work, and congratulations on your daughter's wedding, by the way.
Yeah, thank you.
You think a book tour is hard. Writing a book is hard.
That's right. weddings have a plot as well.
Good luck to you. Thanks so much for coming in today.
I enjoyed it. Thank you so much.
Appreciate your time. You can continue the conversation, listeners, and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.